What I'm going to do is talk very broadly about different aspects of collective nouns, and then we can make up some here and now. Colin's been twittering and putting online some of the ones that I was suggesting, but I'll tell you now so that we can have a think about it. Pianos. What would the collective noun for pianos be? Daffodils. Tapeworms. Zebra. Spin doctors. Ginger people. And atheists. So they're the ones to start thinking about, and we'll do a few more at the end. Collective nouns are almost a kind of counterfactual proposition, and they go to the absolute heart of some kinds of philosophy. G.K. Chesterton, who has become my favourite writer, having gone through university, being an absolutely avowed dyed-in-the-wool modernist and liking James Joyce and Virginia Woolf, as I approach 40, I suddenly discover that my favourite prose writer is a conservative Catholic reactionary. But Chesterton is one of the most beautiful writers I've ever come across. And he had a big debate with H.G. Wells, particularly in a book, Orthodoxy. Wells, in one of his philosophical works, had put forward the proposition, all chairs are different. No two things are completely similar. Chesterton, rather brilliantly, just says, if all chairs were different, then you couldn't do the sentence, all chairs. You're automatically implying that there is some chairiness, some quality of chairosity, which is shared by all chairs. This goes right back to the sort of very first glimmerings of philosophy with Plato's idea of the forms, the idea that all things that we see are mere reflections of the perfect, true form of the thing. Now, forms are obviously a very difficult thing because you have to start saying, at what point does something become something else? So, there might be a Platonic form of the dog, and we can all roughly imagine a dog in our heads just now. Are you thinking of a Labrador? Are you thinking of a poodle? To what extent is a poodle different? Is there a Platonic form of the poodle and a Platonic form of the Labrador? And if that's the case, is there a Platonic form of the poodle before it was bred selectively into this strange kind of accessory animal? It's always struck me. So one of my first points where I was reading and realised that I really need to think hard about it was reading Goethe's Faust. Mephistopheles arrives in the form of a poodle. And, of course, Goethe means a German hunting dog. And I'm thinking, hang on, Mephistopheles is a poodle. This doesn't seem to work somehow, you know. This is the lord of the underworld. That kind of distinction is what Duns Scotus, well, Aristotle attacked the idea of the forms on this basis, that it isn't clear where one thing changes into being another thing. Duns Scotus, the Scottish philosopher that we get the word dunce from, went one step further, and he posited a quality that he called haecitas, which means in Latin roughly thisness, that everything has a particular thisness. So there's a thisness of me, there's a thisness of my finger. This debate between individuality and ultimate individuality and the idea that there are connections, we can say all men, we can say all Scottish people, we can say all telephones. It's been at the heart of sort of the philosophy of being from the outset. It's come up most recently in A Thousand Plateaus by Gilles Deleuze, the French philosopher, where he says, there is no general prescription. We are done with all globalising concepts. Now, in a way, a collective noun is a kind of globalising concept. And looking through all the ones that have been put up on the website, one thing that I've noticed, which is quite strange, is how few breeds are there. There's lots of different collective nouns for particular animals, whether it's zebras or tapeworms, but there's much fewer for Persian cats or Burmese cats. So, you know, that idea about what these things actually are, what the collective noun does, gets to the absolute heart of a philosophy there. Now, having begun with philosophy, I'd like to move on to beginnings. The person who... the person who supposedly did many of the famous ones that we all still know now, like A Murder of Crows, An Exaltation of Larks, An Abomination of... No, she didn't do An Abomination of Monks. she did do, well, this one, A Dopping of Sheldrakes, A Cluster of Grapes, A Chattering of Starlings, A Rout of Wolves, A Herd of Cranes, Team of Oxen. These all came in a book which was published in 1486 by Wynkyn de Worde. I think every book festival should get some reference to Wynkyn de Worde and the UK's second printer. You know, Caxton is our great first printer. Wynkyn is the also-ran. It's a very peculiar book. It's from a book on hunting, shooting and fishing, which was written by one Dame Juliana Burness. Although her name, the vowel is slightly inaccurate. They always transcribe it as Burners now. It's actually Dame Juliana Barnes, and I can't get the thought of Julian Barnes out of my head, particularly given that Juliana Barnes was, if we believe Wynkyn de Worde, the prioress of Sopwell Nunnery. So why this nun was writing a book on hunting and fishing is anyone's guess. But she gives us the first sort of proper list of traditional collective nouns. She's got a great many other words as well. Venery, the kind of general term for all these kinds of hunting, had a very specialised vocabulary. And we might want to think a bit about why that is. I mean, to go through a few of the points, there are different collective nouns for birds when they are flying, birds when they're on the ground, and birds when they're in water. So it's absolutely to do with where it is being killed. It's also a very aristocratic language. It was like the shibboleth that let you into the club, that you knew the particular accurate terms for these things. So rather than being something, what's been great about the All Sorts project is it's been so open and global, given that the origins of a lot of these collective nouns are actually very exclusive and privileged, and that were there as a badge that let you into the club. 1486 is when the Dame Juliana Barnes book is published, the Book of St. Albans. It is obviously earlier. There is an earlier one as well, which is John Lydgate, a poet who's not read much at all nowadays. And actually, reading his stuff again, I thought he has been overlooked rather unfairly. He's a contemporary of Chaucer, and in his book, The Horse, the Sheep and the Goose in 1440, I don't quite know why, he has a whole list of collective nouns at the end of it. The Horse, the Sheep and the Goose is a traditional dialogue poem where the horse, the sheep and the goose all argue about their various virtues and which of them is the best animal. And this has got some of the really sort of famous ones. This is taken from the Abbotsford Club reprint of Lydgate's work. So there is a very, very tangential link to Sir Walter Scott. So you've got things like A Covey of Partridges or A Congregation of Plovers, An Unkindness of Ravens, A Swarm of Bees, A Charm of Finches, A Leap of Leopards. One thing you'll notice is that there's more than one term for different things. The idea that there has to be just one collective noun isn't the case. And the same collective noun can be used for lots of different things. So a cluster of grapes, a cluster of nuts, a cluster of tame cats, but a destruction of wild cats. A pontifical of prelates. I mean, some of them he's obviously being satirical. A charge of curates, a lordship of monks, a superfluity of nuns. Now, it's obviously quite sort of reverent talking about a state of princes or a pontifical of prelates, but having this lordship of monks, a superfluity of nuns, is rather peculiar. I'm just trying to look for the part about women in this.
Giggle.
Giggle, yes. Along with geese. So, I mean, there's a kind of rather sexist medieval humour at work there. The same word is used for geese and for women. And again, right at the beginning of it, looking at these collective nouns in Lydgate's part, you can see all the different ways it's being done. Some are very poetic. An Exaltation of Larks is beautifully poetic. A Gaggle of Women is ribald at best and rather distasteful at worst. And again, looking at the All Sorts project, it's been great seeing how people have taken it on in completely different ways, either doing ones which are terribly incisive and poetic and apposite, and occasionally just putting up quite silly ones. I don't quite know who put up a skank of PR girls, but given I have to deal with them on a daily basis, I can say that only 40% of them could be considered such. So again, we've got this idea of an aristocratic linguistic game that has become something much more open and diverse with this website. We could also think about it in terms of grammar. Now, talking about it, it struck me that a lot of the words that we use for the collector in the collective noun are very strongly linked to verbs. You know, there are ones which is just a noun to a noun, but often it's a noun constructed out of a verb form. So if we take an exaltation of larks, that's coming from a clear verb into that form. And it struck me that what you have with this is like a miniature bit of story DNA. That when you're putting these things together, this verbal form and this noun form, you're telling a very tiny, you know, smaller than a haiku-like story about what's there. That's why I thought the one, An Empty Room of Ninjas, was perfect. You completely have there a story with the idea of the person who's looking at the room plus the person who knows what the truth about it is. Other ones like that which I thought were particularly noticeable. A Crash of Rhinoceroses. Not rhinoceri, that's a real bugbear. The plural is not rhinoceri. But A Crash of Rhinoceroses, you're in some way imagining what it would be like were a rhinoceros to be there immediately. A Shiver of Sharks, which I think is beautiful because it doesn't just reflect the movement of the shark through the water, but what would happen to the person in the water suddenly seeing a group of sharks coming towards them. So almost all of them have had some link between a verb and a noun that gives us this kind of, almost this kind of fossilised tiny remnant of story. And the best ones, the absolutely best ones, whether it's the ones from Lydgate or from Dame Juliana Barnes or the ones on the website, have got that quality of being connected to some idea of a story you can then take away. They're also very similar to the idea of wit. Now, wit nowadays is a bit of a debased word. You know, it isn't just comedy. Coleridge's definition of wit was, Samuel Johnson's definition of wit in The Metaphysical Poets was when he said, the most heterogeneous ideas are yoked by violence together. So you're taking two quite disparate things and pulling them together into one image or metaphor. Other things about the metaphysical wit, was also described as finding similarity in things dissimilar. And again, I think the best collective nouns do that. It gives you some connection that you had not otherwise thought about. So one of the things that I find really difficult when I speak to schools about poetry, similes. If you say the sun is like a penny, you're actually talking about only one aspect of the sun, its circularity. You're not saying you can spend it. You're not saying it's as hot as. You're taking one aspect of a thing and making a comparison to it. What the best collective nouns do is break that open again. And, you know, we don't just go for the lazy surface similarity, surface image, but for something deeper, something that's more about what our engagement with these real things in the world actually is. So in terms of ones that I liked that had particular... Oh, just before I move on from that, Dame Helen Gardner gave her definition of wit, saying, a conceit is a comparison whose ingenuity is more striking than its justness. Mm-hmm. Which I think is absolutely perfect for some of the collective nouns that we can go on to. Of course, what you're not saying is that this is something which applies equally to all members of that class or phyla or species. So ones which I thought were particularly ingenious like that. I thought A Thingamate of Amnesiacs was quite beautiful. And whoever came up with that one really ought to be tremendously well commended. other ones in the same way are a brace of orthodontists, particularly because the word brace obviously is a genuine collective noun referring to two game birds put together. A camp of transvestites I thought was quite good. Again, using some sort of pun there. This one I liked particularly, a quibble of platypuses. Because the platypus, they didn't know whether it should be taxonomised as a mammal or a non-mammal, because although it lays eggs but has, I can't remember quite well, it lactates but it lays eggs as well. So, you know, a quibble of platypuses is brilliant because it builds into it the story about what the platypus has been in our culture and the different ways in which people have worried about the platypus. But also it's just got a kind of onomatopoeic rightness about it. You know, quibble has that kind of link to sort of wateriness, wobbliness, questioning. I thought that was, you know, a genuinely ingenious one. The other one that I quite liked was a bong-suckling of White House staffers, which apparently has been used in an episode of The West Wing, was where it came from. There are other internet sites where people have sort of tried to accumulate collective nouns, and often they kind of split between people who are doing it from a lexicographical perspective, where they're actually trying to find instances of this being used. So, for example, technically it's a herd of zebra. It's cognate with a herd of gazelle and other animals that are like that. And you can find very good lexicographical references of people saying it is definitely a herd of zebra. It somehow seems to me less interesting than the mental fun you can have in thinking up what might be a better word for it. I don't have the actual printout from the web page here, so maybe some of the people who've been involved with it can help me. I thought a barcode of zebra was very lovely. The one I put down was an arbez, to put the word backwards, since, you know, the black and white works that way. So should we do the audience interaction bit now? You all quite happy with that? Pianos. Collective nouns for pianos. Can anyone remember ones that have been on the website? Or
I might have a few in my pocket. So. We should do the audience interaction.
Anyone want to? I thought a 40 of pianos.
Oh, that's good.
Because if it is a collective noun, it means that there are more than one of them. So two at the same time would be louder than one on its own. Again, that's one thing that's kind of quite strange in it. Some of the ones that don't work as well are when people are thinking about just one of the thing and trying to do a word which is an image for it. The absolute principle of the collective noun is that there are more than one of these things being described.
I've got some piano ones here from Twitter. There's a grand of pianos.
Yeah.
An octave of pianos.
That would seem to imply eight to me.
A battle of pianos. A cacophony of pianos. I think that's all I've got here.
Do you want to try for daffodils? I know that one of them was an aged poet of daffodils that somebody put up, given I absolutely detest Wordsworth with a consuming passion. I was
poets.
Delighted. Yeah, yeah.
There's one here, a doff of daffodils.
Mm-hmm.
A doff. Like doffing your hat.
Rhapsody.
Mm-hmm. The one I put down was a simultaneity of daffodils. Because in the poem it is an all at once, mm-hmm. I saw. But in the poem it is a host of shining daffodils. So, I mean, there's a technical... host of golden daffodils. Mm-hmm. Completely redundant when you think about it. I mean, this is just why Wordsworth is such a bad poet. What other kind of daffodils are there? Red ones, or anything, you know? You know, I've never used two words where one could do. But...
Someone's also said a Welsh choir of daffodils.
Tapeworms, not exactly one of the most... this is one that I put in because of the whole thing about collective names. We can all think about a tapeworm, and when I was thinking about it, I was thinking of things like, you know, a writhe or a bung or all the rest of it. But it has to be a collective noun. It has to mean that there's more than one. Now, if one did have more than one tapeworm, the two of them would be fighting it out inside you. You know? Anything about sort of multiple tapeworms would be to be like a civil war of them. What?
So the ones that were suggested were a string of tapeworms, a gut of tapeworms, a leech of tapeworms.
Leech is quite good.
Thread of tapeworms. A knot of tapeworms.
A ticker of tapeworms?
That's very good.
A rhythm of tapeworms?
Yeah, brilliant.
How about
brilliant.
Diet?
So you're getting far more keen on the night. Zebras. Go on, now we can do the zebras for.
What's the crossing, isn't it?
Crossing. A crossing is very. Yeah.
Someone said a gobble of zebras, explaining they hold a lot of food in their mouths.
Which I never knew about zebras. So, no, I've learned something today in the same South Park.
A zenith of zebras?
Zooms.
Mm-hmm.
Zooms of zebras.
What?
Zooms. I'm sure you'll have lots of them for spin doctors. Mm. Anyone want to kick off?
We got a spiral of spin doctors.
That's good.
A distaff?
Yes, I suppose with the idea that there are nothing but gossip mongers, linking it back to the sort of oldest sort of arm.
There's a non-denial of spin doctors. A tangle of spin doctors. It might also work for tape one.
I thought a cover story of spin doctors. Particularly because a story on the cover, it's not the same as a cover story.
Party lines.
Yeah.
A court.
Yeah. I noticed that some people on the website had been using people's names for it, which doesn't happen very often. So yeah, people were saying a Mandelson of spin doctors, or spin doctor, which is kind of like, you know, the Capodoro ring as well. Or what's his name? It's just on his diaries that I mentioned. Campbell.
Yeah.
You know, a Campbell of spin doctors. Campbell of soups would be better. Ginger people.
A burning.
This is where it starts to get a little bit uncomfortable, mm-hmm. and where I want to sort of really explore one of the other last bits of it. So if we do atheists, I mean, the one I came up with for atheists was a superstition, given that the Latin root means to stand above. So, you know,
a revelation.
I think somebody had an absence of atheists. Chesterton, by the way, has the most lovely line in Orthodoxy that if there was no God, there would be no atheists, which kind of sums up every book which has attacked Richard Dawkins, you know, in 8 words rather than, you know, for atheists, were there any?
I don't have them here. I don't actually have an internet connection.
I mean, a Dawkins of atheists? Or who are the other ones? Well, you wouldn't really want a Hitchens of atheists. No, a Hitchens of Trotskyite liars, perhaps. a Hitchens of turncoats.
Pantheon of atheists?
Sorry?
A pantheon of atheists?
Yeah. Yes. Pantheon. Or even a congregation. That's where it does start to be getting difficult. I mean, we can easily sit here and make jokes about a knock of Jehovah's Witnesses and, you know, a cousin of Mormons. But if I said to you, you know, who wants to think up a collective noun for Christians, we could possibly all manage that. If I said, you know, can you think up a collective noun for Muslims or Jews, then it suddenly becomes a slightly darker proposition. That particularly when there are groups who are constantly being defined as all the same by other people, then there is something stranger and darker at the heart of it. I thought it's been one thing which I've thought about the website is it's been very good at keeping away from that side which is more frightening. None of us like to be thought, we all like to be thought of as individual. And there's nothing worse than somebody saying, oh, well, you're actually just like this other person. You know, that, my friend, the novelist China Mayville, in one of his novels, one of the crimes that this culture has developed is class one denial of choice. And I think that's what worries us about the idea that there is a one word that we could all lump these people together with, that there could be one word that would be used to define you, not that you'd be allowed to use to define yourself. There is actually a collective noun for Jews. It's a minyan, which is the minimum number of Jews who can celebrate the reading of the Torah together. That's their word that they chose for themselves. You know, similarly, you can find examples in Muslim ecclesiology and Christian ecclesiology. That when it's the word that people use for themselves, that's fine. When it's the word that's sort of imposed from outside, it's slightly more problematic. And that kind of links me up, just to end on a slightly lighter note, with one thing about Scotland that I had to do. And, you know, there's books there for sale. I know it's terrible to sell them in a second-hand bookshop. You can always just sort of wait and they'll no doubt end up here sooner or later.
Later rather than soon.
Well, I mean, it's... all authors I know play this game where you are... you time how quickly. But it's become no fun with Amazon Marketplace. The second-hand copies are now for sale before the book, in some cases. When I was doing Scotland, one thing I was talking a lot about was Scottish stereotypes. You know, you just need a ginger wig and the ch phoneme, and everybody recognises that as Scottishness. And Scottishness as a stereotype is a really peculiarly difficult one. And looking at the sort of broad history of it, I mean, I couldn't find a collective noun for Scots, so you can all be thinking about that just to end up on. It's very difficult for the Scots to take a position of sort of moral high ground over things like Scottish stereotypes, because we tended to do them first and the English only did them later, or Americans. So, I don't know if you remember Monty Python had a thing about the poet Ewan McTeagle, who all his poems were things like, can you lend me £5 till the end of the week, please? I'm sure it's over the door of the Arts Council. But Ewan McTeagle worked as a joke, but we already had William McGonagall. Russ Abbott used to dress up as a kind of comedy Scot. We already had Harry Lauder. One of the most, you know, other groups have been able to reclaim words like gay, like nigger in the States, when they've been imposed from outside onto people. Even the word Tory was originally an insult. It technically was meant a particular kind of Irish rebel, and the Tories took on that word and made it into their own kind of name for themselves. But when the Scots have done it to themselves, you can't really then reclaim that word if it was you that had started this in the first place. So, collective nouns for Scots.
Walter?
Good one.
For real?
Yeah, that's a nice one. Although I have to say, yeah, too easy. I have to say, Scotland must be the only country. Part of what I did in Scotland, the book, was do kind of walks around Edinburgh. Walking down the Royal Mile, you've got two shops opposite each other. One called The Real Scotland Shop, and one called Scottish Fantasies. What kind of a strange schizophrenic culture is this? Does anyone actually sort of ever set up a shop called The Real England Shop? Or, you know, any culture that's that worried about its own identity is interesting to me. But I think real probably takes it. Any other final guesses? Final chips?
Between an inferiority of Scots and a superiority of Scots.
I think, it could be a bit like the geese and having a different one when they're in the air or on the ground. kind of an inferiority of Scots for 3 years out of every four, then a superiority of Scots every time that the English are playing Germany in the World Cup. You have been an absolutely lovely audience. Do stay and chat. If you want to buy books, somebody will be emptying your pockets of money for me. And thank you once again. This has been delightful.